Welcome back to another episode of the Smashy Business Show. I'm Richard Fitzgerald.
Hi, I'm Saima. My first time, so I would expect some slack.
We'll go easy. So Saima's joining us as a co-host today, and we're going to be chatting all things business as usual. Alfie, HR tech company, there's a story there. Then Riyadh, making waves to do with European companies moving in, and also success in Etadawul. And the third story, we'll talk about Shein, the big app. So Saima, tell us, this is your first Ramadan in Dubai. How are you finding it?
I love it, honestly. I think the best part of my Ramadan in Dubai is the fact that I can venture out in the evening safely. That's the best part of being a woman in Dubai, that you can absolutely be on your own. If you're following, because I follow Love in Dubai, and I saw a nice market at Karama, and I was so inspired by it that I ended up going there the next day.
Oh, wow.
So the vibe, the culture is fantastic. Loving it so far.
You're loving Dubai. Brilliant. And how have you found, you know, the working environment during Ramadan? Do you think it's productive? Do you think it's a business time, or is it slowed down? Or
so the beauty of this sit, you know, like this place is that it has a lot of empathy for people who are fasting. But the people who are fasting are always on the job. The guy who comes in and delivers my stuff is fasting, but he's doing his job. So that gives me a lot of motivation that we will continue to fast, but we'll also continue to do the stuff that we're expected to do. So there's empathy and there's hustle together. So I love that.
Yeah. Brilliant. Good summary. Yeah, so I guess we'll jump into the first story. So it's interesting, the Alfie HR tech. So HR... tech is HR in general, you know, it's humans, and to do tech around it has notoriously been quite challenging. So it was quite a daunting thing that the three kind of founders took on. Not only less than a year ago, Simon, I remember having an interview with the lead founder. I think Yusuf was the CEO at the time on Smashy Business, and it did look quite good. And you know, one of the parts is like, can you get from an MVP to market, and do you have customers? And they did, but then it seemed to fall apart quite quickly. And so basically the story is that Alfie, a HR tech that launched in Dubai a year ago or so, shut down by the end of last year.
Yes.
And we covered it yesterday, and they had a commitment of $2.5 million as funding, but not all the cash got to them. And I think what I remember talking to Yusuf, and I think, and you know, Lubna covered the story in more detail, but I think kind of what's committed and what ends up coming through, sometimes if the investors lose confidence in the sector or in the leadership or in the stats, then they mightn't go through. And I think that's the hardest part of a startup, isn't it?
Absolutely. And that's a classic story that's unfolding in a lot of Shark Tank episodes as well, that a lot of funding commitment is happening on camera.
Yeah.
But in actual reality, a lot of startups are struggling to get through the people who promised funding on TV. So that's pretty much the startup bubble bursting, that I would say. But for Alfie, I'm a bit surprised to see these three successful big brands, tech guys coming together, building a fantastic product. Where did it go wrong? Mm. And where is the leftover money? You know, my curiosity is some of it did hit the bank account. Mm. So what's the theory? Where is that money, and how was that put to use?
Yeah, I think it just, you know, it's obviously, you know, a lot of people say it's a failure, but we have to learn from failures. And in this region, we don't talk about these stories as much. So, you know, the headlines, the X-rays, 1 million, X-rays, 10 million. And these are the business startup stories we've read. And then you hear of the ones that make it success, but you don't really hear of the graveyard. You don't really hear of. And I think it's not important to call people out, but it's important to learn from it.
Absolutely.
And to understand. And then, you know, I made some investments, and I was on a call yesterday with a comic book app out of Europe that the founder is in the US and the CEO is in Europe, and Mark Cuban invested in it. So I'm, and they're shutting down, and they're looking for ways to sort of sell off the assets and things like that.
Yeah.
And this was just a year ago. And like, so these things happen, like that's the risk, especially if you come in at an angel round or if you come in at the start. And that, you know, I remember when my mom had restaurants and stuff, like, it was that first, you had to get through the first 3 years.
Yeah.
If you can get through the first 3 years with your head above water, you know? And I really do think, like, with the startup stuff, like, people might get a headline of $1 million, but that $1 million can go quite quickly.
Yeah.
You know, it really can. And it is tough. And, you know, people obviously, you know, the psychological part of dealing with it is hard, and media coverage around a failure obviously is hard, but you know, the statistics saying what shuts down are very high.
Yeah.
So let's learn from these things, let's celebrate it in a way that they tried, and hopefully, you know, hopefully there are more SaaS startups in the region. Like, you know, we're a company in Dubai, right? How many companies in Dubai pay for American SaaS products?
Yeah.
Right. And other SaaS products, but why don't we have more? Why isn't the money going to tech startups in the region a bit more? So, you know, hopefully, if Alfie don't make it, you know, there's Bezat in the HR sector, and they had to do some layoffs as well. But hopefully, they'll get through, and hopefully, we'll all will be using.
Absolutely. So, there were three young entrepreneurs who came together and. Mm. And this region is promoting a lot of young startups, young entrepreneurs coming in. You've been in the business for so many years. What's the secret sauce to crack the first 3 years? Is it perseverance? Is it, how does it happen when you get funding? How do you manage that? You know, for the lot of people who are watching the show who are planning to start up or you know, like in the early stages, how do you navigate a tough situation like this when investors are not showing confidence?
Yeah, it's a hard one. I think you can either have a hit at the start, product market fit, where you see the stats, and that's almost easy, right? Because then you're in demand and it's kind of who to say no to money, right? You know you've got something, right? Sometimes people hit a home run in their first startup, sometimes it's their third. But this sort of product market fit thingy that you just get subscribers, get revenue, get users, the data is working. But some people launch something to market and it's tumbleweeds. It's like, you have to work really hard to get a customer in. And that's where the pivot, that's where the real struggle comes. And what point do you give up? What point do you stop? What point do you pivot? And so they're both different answers. They're both different things. So, you know, I personally, like when I left sort of Mindshare, that group and that WPP set up, I jumped into a startup that had raised money. And I didn't personally feel comfortable with having burn rate. You know, the CEO was sort of quite confident that he had a runway of whatever it was, that we can afford to lose $50,000 a month. And for me, that's like, what? Like, you know, but then in a zero-sum game and in a funding round, you need to do that. I understand it. But it just didn't seem comfortable to me. So when I did this content business, we went through the cash in the first 18 months. But in the first month, I knew we had product market fit because I saw the audience numbers. So I knew the product, I knew the users were there.
Yeah.
I just didn't have the money. I didn't have the revenue. So I think that's very confident that if then you know you need to stay
Absolutely.
In the game. If and I think with Alfie, if they and you know, Yusuf, they did have people using the app.
Yeah.
And I think at that point you almost need the investors to stick together. And you need to, but it's a tough job because like you're managing lots of things. Yeah. But if you have stats, then just try and manage the money around it and
Absolutely.
Try and kind of stick together. But if you don't have stats, if you got no users, I think you do need to pivot or at some point.
So everything's about the product market fit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I would, it's interesting you said about Shark Tank. I would like to think that there's some clauses in those contracts that you can't just say it on camera.
So actually, there are two sides to the story is what I've heard. A lot of startups who come and make a claim sometimes end up not being true. So the side of the story is that what investors say that, you know, they painted a rosy picture, but when we went back, we realized that the monies and the books were not so good.
Yeah.
But a lot of them are struggling to get time with the investors because time is also promised on the show. A lot of them are struggling to get time from the investors and also money. So there are two sides to the story.
Yeah, I mean, Shark Tank is a show. You know, it's not an incubator.
Theatrics,
it's not you know, there are really good, like Flat Six Labs, there are really good incubators with mentors. You know, there's Y Combinator in the US. Like there are ways to help people through the journey.
Yeah.
But sometimes when I hear this about like blaming the investors and stuff like that, I don't like this I don't like this victimhood thing. Like,
agree with you.
You know, I don't really like it. I think
that's why I say that there's always two sides to the story.
It's easy to say, hey, why didn't you work? We didn't have the money.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, make money then.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's move on. So Riyadh, you know, when Riyadh announced Program HQ a couple of years ago, people were quite surprised. It was kind of like, hey, you have to up sticks, you have to move. But it seems to be working. And this headline yesterday on the Smashy Business, you can read in our newsletter on Instagram, and you can see that there's 350 European companies moving their HQs to the capital. What I find interesting about that is that, you know, it's not necessarily take people from Dubai. It's kind of like people who want to move into the Middle East that didn't know an entry are being wooed into Saudi with incentives and stuff like that. Ambassador Luigi Di Maio, he's the European Union Special Representative to the Gulf, announced that 350 companies licensed headquarters in Riyadh aligns with Saudi Arabia's aim to become a hub for 480 companies by 2030.
Yeah, so, yeah, absolutely. That's really impressive. And that looks like a lot of jobs coming in Riyadh and a lot of people wanting to make Riyadh their base because we were at LEAP, you know, like only last month, and we saw the enthusiasm in, you know, tech leaders wanting to, you know, move, build something in Riyadh. So this essentially is, like you said, an entry point for a lot of people wanting to move to Middle East.
Yeah, and I like it that they're approaching it as European Union. The bilateral FDI stocks increasing by 50% with over 1,300 European companies now investing in Saudi Arabia. And I see it. I see when delegations from Europe come here. Like I know from the Irish Enterprise Ireland and the Irish trade missions, you know, we see they have meetings in Dubai and they have meetings in Riyadh, and they're looking at ways to bring their companies in.
Absolutely.
Some of our team and I had you know, the privilege to attend the opening of a really nice office in downtown recently for Ferrero, right? And the Italian ambassador was there. So you can see that the politics linked with diplomacy, with business, and obviously Ferrero are, you know, Kinder,
absolutely,
Nutella, and they're part of the national pride of Italy of exports. So people, you know, Dubai is building that trust, but these European countries aren't picking Riyadh over Dubai per se. They want to do both.
They want to do both markets. Absolutely. And they're also, the EU has supported the move by establishing the first European Chamber of Commerce in the Gulf, which essentially is a reflection of how seriously they're looking at it and how much they're working to strengthen the ties between the two regions. So absolutely, like you said, it's not about Riyadh, it's Dubai and Riyadh both.
I think you know, obviously people who have KPIs to grow the FDI in Dubai will be looking at this as, why isn't it coming here? But I think people who have the wider all rising tides lift all boats approach, and you know, as a business, as our business here, you know, we want all the economies across the region to be good.
Absolutely.
And it's quite attractive. If the economy grows in Saudi, then you can have two lucrative entities.
Absolutely.
And speaking of that, the Tadawul exchange in Saudi listed its 400 securities. So there's a lot happening there. There's a lot happening in the IPO. But let's move on to our third story, because I know we do have a very good guest coming up.
Yeah.
So the third story is about Shein, how do we pronounce it?
Shein, and a little fun fact that when I moved to Dubai, the first thing I did was I have to order from Shein. Last year, Shein was banned from India.
Ah, okay.
It's one of the most favorite products for women there. Because of the way it's priced, their pricing strategy. So the first thing when I moved to Dubai was, let me order a stash from Shein.
And did you?
Yeah, and
is
maybe
this
that's
from Shein, what you're wearing now?
This is purely Indian, but okay, maybe the profits are doubling because people like us keep ordering.
Yeah. Amazing.
$2 billion, yeah.
Huge profits, right?
Yeah.
But just tell us a little bit about that. So most people would know that some apps are blocked in India, Chinese apps, because of maybe in Indian China, you know, competitiveness. We know that TikTok is banned because people can understand why social networks would be banned. But why is an e-commerce app banned?
It's purely political because of the tensions between the two countries. So TikTok and Shein were banned together, and a host of other apps. A lot of friends lost jobs around before COVID.
So it was basically a Chinese blanket ban.
Absolutely.
It wasn't like, hey, let's block social media, and that's not another. And are there, you mentioned that, you know, it was popular there, but I'm sure there's other e-commerce apps.
Nothing like Shein, Rich. Like the way they crack the price, there's Zara, there's H&M, but we see the profit, the difference in profits between Shein and Zara and H&M. I was just reading up before I joined the show that there's a huge, vast difference, and Shein, you know, like delivers quality on time. So I had friends who were ordering in Dubai, and their friends would come and get it for them. That's the kind of craze people had back home.
Really? Yes. That's fascinating. Yeah. And obviously they're growing in the region, but they're eyeing up an IPO, and a lot of Chinese companies, even though there's this whole tension with the US, a lot of them do choose to list on the NASDAQ in Saudi. So they might do New York or London, but it'll be interesting to see. I think in the future it'd be great if some of them would list here if they don't want to list in Hong Kong or whatever. But you know, if you're an institutional investor and you see those profits, you're asking your banks, whoever's leading this IPO, you're saying, get me in there, because I don't think even Amazon was profitable when they went public all those years ago. So to see $2 billion in profits
and then get for an IPO is fantastic. And yeah, they're seeking approvals from China to list themselves on in New York and London, because 10,000 people still work in China.
10,000 people, wow. And you know, just to you know, to put this in perspective, like Zara, who own Berkshire and Massimo Dutti, they're still way ahead. They're still at $7.4 billion in profits in 2023. But there is a shift happening from bricks and mortar to kind of e-commerce,
absolutely,
isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. If you're wondering where Rich is reading all those information from, you know where to go. It's on the Smashy Instagram page. You get everything there. And of course, one interesting part about Shein is, I think, is how they've literally beautifully copied their competitors at half the price.
Yeah. And one of the tricks is that they do it print on demand, so they don't buy huge stock per season. They disrupted this sort of like seasonal autumn wear, spring wear, and they go what's popular. And interesting, we have just launched Love and Merch on our website, and we've done the same thing. So watch out, Shein, we're coming. No, it's with our partner Merchless, so it is print on demand as well. And it, you know, it doesn't come in 2 hours, but it'll come in a few days. And you know, they have a strong presence in the region. They came here in 2016, so you know, backing up what Simon mentioned about moving to Dubai and it being available. So they've launched a Saudi Arabia-focused reality show, Shein Travel Diaries, in partnership with Rotana Media Group. So they're doing branded content in the region as well, which is really interesting. And it's cemented a physical footprint in the EMA, Europe, Middle East, and North Africa. So region by opening a regional HQ in Dublin, which has attractive corporate tax. But maybe we'll see more offices and Saudi soon as well.
Absolutely. And I think that it's always a bit challenging for young homegrown businesses to compete with a fast fashion brand like Shein.
Yeah.
So yeah, exciting times ahead.
Exciting times ahead. And you know, hopefully we'll have our own Shein from the region
soon. Inshallah.
Yeah. All right, well, let's move to the guests. We have a special guest coming on the show now.
Yeah, and if you are wanting to move to the US, planning an immigration, we have the best guy who did almost 6% of the global US filing of visas. So we have the man today.
Excellent. Okay, that's Shai Zamanian, and he's coming up now, an international EB-5 specialist US licensed lawyer.
Welcome to the show, Shai.
Thank you.
I really was fascinated by the personal story. I'll start with that. You are a first-generation immigrant. How did that impact your professional life?
Absolutely. So America, place of immigrants, you know, over a million immigrants come through every year. And so my family and I, we left the war-torn nation from this region, made it to the U.S., ultimately for the future betterment of myself and my younger brother, to get better educated, to live out the lives that we've ultimately wanted. So that has been a major aspect of my life and the driving force behind what we do at the American Legal Center.
So that's how it all, the idea came upon of you becoming a lawyer and help other people live that life?
Well, the idea of becoming a lawyer, I think I can attribute that to my mother, who pushed me to do it. I think ultimately I wanted to study history. She said, finish law school and then you can buy all the history books you want. So, you know, the reason why I chose law, and so it was definitely the family, but, you know, I'm being facetious. Yes, I love what I do. And this was just where the pull of the universe took me. I had never visited Dubai, didn't have friends or family here. I just packed about 3 suitcases, showed up here about 11 years ago and thought, let's give it a shot. And it was an idea and an experiment on how to educate the public here to see if it would work out. And here we are 11 years later. We have filed the most golden visas to the US from this region. We service the entire region. And it's been quite the journey for sure.
6% of global applications in June of 2021. That's impressive. That's really impressive.
Thank you.
What sets you apart? You know, how were you able to achieve such a big number?
Okay, so there are a lot of consultancies out there that will sort of speak with you in terms of finding a path to Canada, to UK, to all types of places. And so what's different about us is that we're laser focused on the US program, in essence become a think tank of just ideas when it comes to getting people from this part of the region to the US. We are a team of US licensed lawyers. And because we're laser focused, we've become distinguished in exactly what we do. You know, you don't necessarily go to an Italian restaurant and try and order sushi. You should try and go to a place where it's specialized in exactly what it is that you're looking for. And that's what we're here to serve up.
Since we have an expert on the show, I want you to elaborate a little bit about the global, you know, the golden visa process for people who are wanting to make the move. If they would come to you, what can they expect?
Okay, so when you come to us in hopes of finding a path to the US, I think first and foremost, we have to get to know each other. We don't take every client right off the bat. I've got to better understand your outlook, your documents. If I don't sense you're going to be successful, unfortunately, we don't take you on. I didn't move here 11 years ago to waste people's time, or even my own. So after we get to know each other, we pre-qualify your file. We start, you know, looking into the actual filing of the application. So the U.S. Golden Visa is an opportunity for an investor, their spouse, and children under the ages of 21 to be able to have access, gain residency, a green card to the U.S., and ultimately then to the U.S. passport. I think about 85% of my clients from this region are really doing it for the future benefit of the kids.
Yeah.
The kids are a huge element to the bigger picture. There's a lot of value that you will unlock when it comes strictly to education, especially for the kids. Myself, primary school, middle school, high school, my parents did not pay. I attended public school in the US, in California, which was a lovely springboard for me to then go off to universities. And even then, my parents were not out of pocket for educational expenses.
Yeah.
Once you become a US person, the US government does, in most instances, step into the shoes of the parents in providing bursaries, grants, scholarships, and even 0% government loans so that every person, once you're a US person, has the ability to access higher education as well. So really, we've got a contingency of clients from the GCC. Unfortunately, you and I cannot stay here forever based on the current rules.
I was coming to that, yes.
Based on the current rules. And so Dubai ends up being a wonderful stepping stone to your next big venture in life. And so that's why we're here, to build that gap between East and West and to provide solutions so that families can ultimately become successful in making their transition to the US.
So education and retirement are the two big factors that bring people to you.
Education, I would say, is the number one reason, but also, yes, retirement. We do have families that know that their kids are going to study in the US, and ultimately the family wants to be together.
Yeah.
The truth is, when the kids go off to the US to study, they begin making their connections, their you know, friendships, their communities in the US. They want to stay there. It'd be unfortunate for parents to be then separated from the kids. So it's multi-generational planning with education and retirement definitely built in.
And a lot of people from Dubai are wanting to move to the US. If I were to make a plan to move to the US, what would be the right things to look for as someone who wants to move to the US? 37, I have a good career here. What are the things that I could look at before I come to you?
Sure, sure. So, you know, there are certain countries out there in the world that have wonderful programs for highly skilled, youthful people, Canada being one of them. The United States, based on you know, mandates from Congress or the lack thereof, we don't really have those types of programs where you're given points or better credit or access to the US based on skills. Family reunification remains to be the number one way to gain access if you've got family that's in the US. Alternatively, if you're highly skilled in tech sectors, okay, science, technology, math, engineering, these backgrounds would provide you what's called an H-1B. However, that's now a lottery system where I would say about maybe 25% actually make it through.
Yeah.
But then from this region, what I find is many people are choosing to go down the proven path of investment. In the same way, we have so many dialogues about secondary passports or even the UAE Golden Visa.
Yeah.
The discussion about, okay, I've made my money, I've done what I needed to do, I've got my savings, let me sell off one of my apartments that I had previously bought from Amar that I don't really need anyway, and do this multi-generational planning.
Yeah.
And so you invest $800,000, even with a payment plan, in government pre-approved projects, and you can go the investment way as well. What's extraordinary is, based on the recent rules, you can invest now, file now, and move now.
Nice.
So previously you had to wait many months, if not years, to receive the approval.
Yeah.
Now there are new mandates where you can essentially file your application and move tomorrow. And that's what we're doing.
That's fantastic. So you have like a plethora of clients from the region, and you would have fantastic stories of success. If you had to pick one of yours, which your success story, I would love to know a personal story.
Absolutely. So, you know, being in this region and operating out of our offices in downtown Dubai, it has been a roller coaster. So I moved to the Middle East to assist families. And then we had this lovely character by the name of Donald Trump who came into office and then initially and right off the bat instituted what we now look back and call the Muslim ban, meaning if you're from certain nationalities, you were not allowed or given a U.S. visa. Notwithstanding, I had so many clients from Syria, Iran, Sudan, and all these countries affected whereby they had gotten their approvals for the Golden Visa, but the embassy in Abu Dhabi did not know what to do in terms of whether to apply or give them the visa or not. When a government agency is stuck or is unsure on how to apply policy, this is ripe for what's called a writ of mandamus. It's an extraordinary instrument where you employ in the federal courts of the US, where you ask the federal courts to step in and to provide some guidance. So we took this issue on because it wasn't guys and girls like me out in Shanghai and other parts of the world that had to deal with this. It was us that were affected.
Absolutely.
And so for that reason, you know, we took this issue in the federal courts of the US and we won on first instance. And all of my clients, whether they were Syrian, Iranian, Sudanese, or otherwise, they all made it through. Everyone's in the US. I don't do denials.
You played a huge role during that time. You were instrumental in navigating that ban.
I think we also had a little bit of luck, as in life.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So we take our jobs very seriously. We love what we do, and definitely come see us. Everyone's got a different story in life, different perspectives. Let's get to know each other, and perhaps there's you know, a path for you, and a different story for you in life. So.
I love how you mentioned luck in the entire immigration process. That does play a huge role, right?
Doesn't it, in the game
of
life?
Yeah, absolutely.
With luck, what I find is, the truth is, the harder you work, the more luck you tend to have.
Yeah.
And we definitely, I'm proud of my team and everything that we've accomplished, and we hope to continue to spread the word and provide solutions for GCC residents.
The numbers are fantastic. The success rates are fantastic. And I know that you are a great advocate of the Western education model. Why do you think, this is my last question, children in Dubai should definitely consider US for their big move in terms of getting their higher degree?
I mean, I will say something controversial, and that's fine. I don't believe we've got the institutions and the setup here. You know, the universities, for example, the American University in Dubai, I just don't think that that compares to the institutions that are then available that have been around for many generations in the U.S. and in terms of research facilities and the tools necessary for children to then be able to ultimately become successful adults. I don't think necessarily we're there yet from this region, but it's understandable. Yeah. Western countries have you know, these institutions, you know, have been around for hundreds of years, whereas we're lucky that we're only a part of the beginning of the story here.
Yeah.
And so when I say these things, I don't mean it from, you know, plight or trying to make a negative comment. You know, it's not about negative comments. It's about the reality of the situation and wanting to provide solutions. And so here we are.
Awesome. I'm coming soon to you. I have the address. Thank you so much for being on the show. It was a fantastic conversation. Good luck with everything.
Thank you so much for having me. We'll see you again, hopefully.
Thanks.